Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, my lovely Betwixters. I'm back again. You're back again. And that really is the most important thing, because if you weren't back again, this is just a mad woman talking into a microphone with absolutely nobody listening to her. So I'm very glad that you are here again. But before we can keep going on our little journey together, you know, it's the fair dues warning. This is an adult podcast spoken by adults to other adults about adulty things in an adulty way, covering a range of adult subjects, and you should be an adult too. It does seem kind of silly that I have to keep issuing this warning at the top of a show, which is quite clearly about sex, but I've actually got to the point where I enjoy doing it now, so that's just it. Fair dues forevermore. Let's do this! Come take a seat, Betwixters, and thank you so much for donning such a fabulous toga. We are here in 350 BCE ancient Greece, and we have arrived just in time for the infamous trial of Phryne, one of the most famous and frankly fabulous courtesans of her, and well, of all time, actually. Phryne is on trial with three accusations put against her, one of them being that she organised unlawful thyasei, which were apparently debauched meetings. I've never been to one of them, but I have been to a Wetherspoons, and I think that that might have been kind of the same thing. To add to the drama, this case has been brought against her by a former lover, Athusias. What a dick. But fear not, because she is being defended by one of her current lovers, Hyperides. See, it's a hot mess already. And the trial is about to reach its dramatic conclusion. And in a moment that shocks the court, just as she's about to be found guilty and sentenced to death, Hyperides rips off Phryne's dress to expose her nude body to the room. And the jury thinks to themselves, well, with tits like that, she can't possibly be guilty, and they let her off. That's the story. That's apparently what happened. Now, I don't know if this has set any kind of legal precedent. I don't know if we can still do that if we're facing charges, but I'm just going to throw it out there. It might be worth a go, guys. And if you think that incident sounds completely bonkers, well, you've heard nothing yet, because the life of this woman is incredible.
What do you look for in a man?
Oh, money, of course.
You're supposed to rise when an adult speaks to you.
I make perfect copies of whatever my boss needs by just turning a knob and pushing a button.
ERA! Now! ERA! Now!
Yes, social courtesy does make a difference.
Goodness, what a beautiful time. Goodness has nothing to do with it, dearie.
Hello and welcome back to Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, with me, Kate Lister. Big news to start with, Betwixters. This episode, this one right now going into your lugholes, would you believe it or not, it's our 200th episode on Betwixt. 200. Whew, that is incredible. And from me and from everyone at the Betwixt team, we wanted to just say a huge, huge thank you to everyone that's been along with us for the journey. Whether you've just joined or whether you've been here from the beginning, we're just thrilled to have you on board. Here is to the next 200. Now, given it's going to take us a while to light all 200 candles on our birthday cake, I guess we may as well crack on with the episode. And today, fitting for such an occasion, we are exploring one of my most favourite women in history, Phryne, a courtesan from ancient Greece who went from humble, impoverished beginnings to being one of the most celebrated and wealthy women of her time. She was truly remarkable. Joining me is Melissa Funk, author of Phryne, A Life in Fragments, to tell us everything that she has found out about this captivating woman. How were Phryne and other sex workers viewed in ancient Greece? What were her relationships with artists and philosophers at the time like? And what was her legacy? Well, I am ready to find out if you are. Hello and welcome to Betwixt the Sheets. It's only Melissa Funky. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well today. How are you?
Oh, I am thrilled that you are here because we are going to talk about one of my most favourite historical people. And I just saw your book that is out. Was it last month?
Last week.
On Freeney?
Yes.
Last week. And I saw it. And as soon as I saw it, I emailed the producers to be like, we've got to get around. I need to talk about this one. So I suppose my first question is, what brought you to Freeney and what made you want to tell her story?
Oh, that's a great question. So I've been working on the hetairai, which is a Greek word for, it means female companion, but really it's a euphemism for really an upscale sex worker by the time we get to the 4th century.
Like escort.
Yeah, when Freeney is alive. And so I had worked on some letters, some fictional letters that were written from the perspective of sex workers, of hetairai. Way back in the day, doing my master's, so I won't say how long ago that was, but long ago, I was interested in, again, women's voices, because in antiquity, we have very few examples of real women's voices, but we do have lots of authors who are very interested in ventriloquizing women. And so I was looking at these letters. They're by an author named Alciphron, who is very detailed. I think of him kind of like the Wes Anderson of antiquity.
Oh, nice.
The first letter is, at least in the way this collection is arranged, is a letter from Phryne to one of the most famous sculptors of antiquity. His name is Praxiteles. And she's asking him to come to her in a religious sanctuary where there is a statue of Aphrodite, a statue of Eros, so the embodiment of like sexual desire, and a statue of herself in a sanctuary of Eros. And she's saying, come lie with me. Like, let's have sex in this sanctuary. And we won't defile anything. I mean, the general rule is that you do not do things like that in a sanctuary. Mm. But here she is, and she's so bold, and she's so desiring. And we very rarely see expressions of women's desire articulated in ancient Greek literature. We see it a little bit, for example, with Sappho, but not a lot and not so bold. And so I thought, who is this woman? Because I knew she had been a historical woman. Who is she? I've got to know more about her. And so I sort of, you know, have been working and touching on this topic for years, but I've more from a literary perspective. And then a few years ago, I thought, that's a book. I need to write to figure out the biographical tradition of Phryne, because she has all of these compelling stories and anecdotes, all these things. She's always very witty. She's getting the best of famous men. But I've got to know what her story was and all the evidence that we have for it. So really, this book was sitting down and collecting all of the evidence and then thinking about how the story of a woman like Phryne, who seems glamorous, right? She's a sex worker. She becomes very wealthy. She's notoriously so stunning that no one can resist her. How did that story get told? And so that's where all of this came from. But what I will say is that her story and the way it's told certainly distorts, I think, a lot of the real woman, the real historical Phryne.
I was so impressed to see a biography out there, because I'd always assumed that people like Phryne, who exist very much on the margins, and that they're, she's almost, well, she is a fantasy. She was a real person, but the stories that surround her, this legendary Greek courtesan who amassed a fortune and could, you know, run rings around men and always had a quick witticism back. But there's nothing in her voice. It's always people writing about her. So how did you overcome that? What sources are you using for this?
So a lot of our sources for Phryne come in the generations after she was born, or after she lived, pardon me. But one of the chapters does deal with speculating about her life. So again, it's very challenging. The sources from her own life are comedies, the ones that refer to her. And they make jokes. One of the playwrights calls her a Charybdis, like the giant whirlpool, mythological whirlpool that swallows down ship captains and the ships alongside them, right? Because she's so greedy in her relationships. And there's other jokes about, oh, she was a caper gatherer when she was young. And so whether that's saying she was quite poor when she was young, or it's more likely probably a dirty joke of some kind that we don't quite get. So there are these little tantalizing references to her from her own lifetime. And we have a couple of fragments of the very famous court case where she went to court and famously, spoiler alert, she was acquitted because she took off her clothing in the middle of the courtroom. At least that's the story that's been told. So we have a couple of fragments of that speech. That's all that comes from her lifetime. That's it. So when the stories start to be told about her, that happens in the Hellenistic period when you have all of these scholars working at Alexandria. Mm. And they're very obsessed with classical Athens, with the fourth century in particular, when Phryne was alive. And so they start telling stories about the hetaira, about these women. We might call them courtesans, but you know, just think upscale sex workers. And they are very interested in finding these women, but it becomes a genre unto itself to write about hetaira. And the genre is of anecdotes. So it's never more than a few lines. Mm. It's always something like, Phryne met a man and she stated her price. He said, that's too high. She said, hang around and I'll charge you less if I feel like I want it. That's the type of anecdote. And we find this about a variety like lice, glycera, a bunch of women who lived in the fourth century. So that's how her story starts to be told, is with these little fairly generic anecdotes, right? The things that Phryne is said to say could be said by any of these hetairai. But what starts to happen once we get into the Roman imperial period, so about the first century CE and the second century CE, is we have authors who are really interested in how these women might have thought.
Mm, okay.
And so they start doing dialogues of hetairai, or they start, like Alciphron, they start writing letters in their voices. And so there's sort of a reclamation.
The original men writing women.
Exactly. Ventriloquism, right? And there's this reclamation of their voices, of Phryne's voice in particular. She gets kind of most of the attention because she's sort of the hetaira par excellence. She's the one that everyone refers back to. But in this process, they make them a lot bolder and they characterize them more richly. So, you know, we kind of get away from Phryne and then we get back to a different kind of Phryne with this boldness that, you know, it might reflect what she was really like, but it certainly is sort of a response to the genre of literature that these authors, people like Alciphron, people like Lucian are writing in, you know, once we get into the imperial period.
And you do see this archetype that's created in someone like Phryne. I don't know, you might call him a tart with a heart, or like the larger than life, you know, bulshy, brash sex worker who is, you know, hard-nosed, but also cares for people. And you see that repeating in many of the great courtesans. Nell Gwynne would be a great example. There's lots of stories about how her wit was legendary. And there's all kinds of these witty, very intelligent women. And they seem to have started with this woman. I can't think of anyone earlier, second century BCE.
No, we might think about Aspasia, but Aspasia, I don't think really was historically a sex worker. She was accused of it by comic playwrights. Aspasia is the partner of Pericles, the great Athenian statesman in the 5th century BCE, but she's often assumed to have been a sex worker. And I think part of this is just she was a public and unusual woman. And so comic playwrights said she's running a brothel, or they accused her of these kinds of things, but it probably doesn't reflect the reality of her life. And I think sometimes we find in some of those accusations, obviously in the ancient world, a little bit of pornophobia, where, you know, to be a sex worker is the worst thing I can accuse you of. So Aspasia is known as being like a bright woman. And some people have suggested, you know, she was the one who taught Socrates. She's a model for Diotima in the symposium. So she might be the sort of earliest model of this. But really, it's women like Phryne. It's that fourth century where it really, really kicks off. And I think part of what that is all about, too, and the reason that people can make jokes about them is that they also start to feature in court cases in the fourth century in Athens. So Athenian men start taking sex workers to court quite often, it seems. We have, you know, quite a few examples of this. And so I think they start to kind of take on a place in the public eye in that way because of all of these accusations. They're accused of doing things like presenting themselves as Athenian women, presenting their children as Athenian, when if you're a sex worker, you cannot be Athenian. You can't have a legitimate child. But I think that's sort of where you see that footprint, where they start to really enter the public eye. And you can see in those court cases and in the comedies, you see the people of Athens going, we are really, really intrigued by these women. Yeah. We find them so compelling, but we don't really have a spot to put them. They don't fit comfortably where our wives and our daughters and our mothers do. So how do we treat them? What should we do? You know, and then we're going to put them on the comic stage. We're going to talk about them all the time. They're a little bit obsessed with them, I think, in the fourth century. But this is where that idea of this larger than life, I think, personality comes into play. And it starts to build from that.
It's incredible, isn't it? That it kind of all, you can be traced back to this particular group of people and what they were and the fascination that people have with them. And that's something that I wanted to ask you about, because we have this idea of ancient Greece, of it being this kind of hedonistic sexual paradise where everybody, you know, gets the jollies on. It was actually quite conservative, especially for women. They didn't like, and if you read pretty much any compliment about an ancient Greek woman, it will say chaste in there. It will say she's a chaste woman, she's a modest woman, and she's fabulous at sewing or whatever the hell it is. So how, when they so value chastity and modesty, does someone like Phryne become like a celebrity? Is she respected? I'm not sure. But like this cultural fascination around with her, how does you square that circle?
So I think, and I spend a lot of time thinking about why classical Athenians are so obsessed with women. You know, they put them on stage in these plays that are written by men and performed by men. You have you do have, you know, at least half women characters, and characters like Medea and Clytemnestra. These are not shrinking violets that you're throwing on stage. What I think is that when you have such a strict society and you're operating it in this very strict way, obviously, or ideally it's that strict, you know, we know everyone has ideals, cultural ideals, and very few people actually live up to them.
True.
Right? Even if they're strict. And if it's strict, you often have more of that stuff happening behind the scenes. Right. So, you know, I suspect some of what you were just saying about ancient Greece, you know, there was some of that going on for sure. But you've got to navigate that difference between ideals and realities. Right. So we have these strict ideals, but in reality, we are seeing women out of the household. You know, we know citizen women, for example, had to go out and work sometimes to pay the bills, to keep their families going. And some of them would have entered sex work for sure. So you've got these ideals that are challenging to live with. And you're kind of recognizing that for women, it's a very specific kind of challenge to live with these too. And you've got to navigate it somehow. And I think that comes out in this obsession. And again, you have a woman, say like Phryne, who, because she's a sex worker, she's also foreign, which in Athens in the fourth century, you know, limits some of her rights. It also means that she has to pay a certain kind of tax every month. But she's probably the head of her own household, which is very unusual. That is not ideal for an Athenian woman. And she's moving through social circles in ways that an Athenian woman, an Athenian wife or a daughter can't quite do or shouldn't quite do.
Yeah.
And I think that is very challenging because, you know, there's a woman who can live in different parts of the city, who can move through different circles and have access, especially probably to young elite men, wealthy men, that other women can't or shouldn't. And the Athenians are really trying to figure out how they feel about that.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think that comes out in that obsession with these women, the taking them to court, you know, the putting them on stage all the time. There are so many sex workers on stage in the fourth century in comedy in particular. So you can see that obsession and that discussion getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
It's like they can't work out how they feel about them, because it's like they're like, well, they're not good and chaste and moral, so we can't respect them like we do with their mothers. And yet we can't stop talking about them. So it becomes this strange focal point for a lot of writers.
Yes. Yeah. And again, the one thing we see too is that, you know, with these court cases in particular, the men who are associated with the sex workers too, clearly they haven't squared the circle of how they're interacting with these women, because it seems like when things go sour for whatever reason, they're like, okay, in you come, I'm going to take you to court because I can. And because I'm an Athenian man, I have access to this.
They turn very quick.
Yeah. And you're very vulnerable in that situation as a foreign woman or a sex worker without rights. So you see the way that they use the mechanisms of the Athenian state, right, against these women. And I think that's also some of that discomfort with women who don't fit in tidily into their system. That's how they're working it out, too, is, you know, by punishing them, literally.
God, fascinating. So what do we know about Phryne then? This is a woman that men love to tell stories about.
Yes.
But do we know, for example, where she was from?
Yes. So we have a few things that I'm pretty certain that we can say, yes, this is true of Phryne.
Okay.
She's from Thespiae, which is a town in Boeotia. So it's just kind of north. It's near Thebes, north of Attica and Athens. But Thespiae is the hometown of that sanctuary of Eros. So it's kind of wonderful that this, the most beautiful, desirable sex worker of the fourth century comes from the hometown of sexual desire, basically. Right.
It's kind of like if she came from Paris today.
Yeah, exactly. We can talk about this later, but there's definitely a connection with Frinny and Paris and sex work that happens later on, too. But yeah, so she's from Thespia. And so she clearly, again, isn't Athenian. This means she can't have Athenian civil rights, the rights that an Athenian woman or man would have access to. So we know she's from there. I'm certain it's said a million times. Mm. She apparently had a statue at Delphi of her by Praxiteles, this famous sculptor, that said Phryne, the daughter of Epicles of Thespiae. So she's actually claiming her family roots there too in that way. So then the question becomes, was she brought to Athens?
Yeah.
Was she free when she came to Athens? That's the challenge to navigate. I think she was probably free, but it's not uncommon for sex workers to have been enslaved, at least when they're younger. You know, we do have examples of sex workers who earned enough money to free themselves or were helped to be freed by patrons, for example. But so for her, again, was she enslaved or not? She probably entered the sex trade at a very young age. We do have lots of evidence of sex workers who enter. There's a very famous legal speech against Neaera, which basically gives us, it's our most fulsome narrative of a woman's life from the 4th century in Greek. And it tells us about her being enslaved in Corinth as a young woman. Pardon me, a young girl. I should be very clear. The terms that are used in Greek suggest a child. And it's very clear, a young child. So we see kind of the path, the possible path that someone like Phryne could take.
Yeah.
And we can see perhaps by using those bits of historical evidence, we can kind of speculate about a woman like Phryne. Again, how she kind of moved into Athens and then moved in and around the social circles there. So again, she's from Thespiae. What else can we say? She definitely became very wealthy. Mm. I think that's certain that she has all of these reputations. It's very common to say sex workers are greedy, but I think in particular, there are a set of anecdotes about her fabulous wealth. So I think she did become wealthy. Therefore, she had to have been free at least by that point. She certainly did go to court. We know that. Mm. She probably didn't reveal her nude body at the end of the case, though. But that's almost the sum total of what we know about her. We don't know about her death. We have a couple of anecdotes of her in old age where she says things like she's selling her dregs, basically. She's making a joke about, you know, old wine and that her reputation is her dregs, but she can still, because her reputation is so significant, she can charge still a high price, even though what's left isn't so great anymore. But we don't know what sort of happens to her at the end of her life, right? And so what we really end up with is this snapshot of Phryne in this active period where she is this grand hetaira, right? And when she's this glamorous figure, this notable figure in Athens. But that fulsome biography just isn't there, unfortunately.
She modeled, or at least was said to have modeled, for Praxiteles, the very, very famous...
Praxiteles, yeah.
Thank you. The very famous sculptor. And the statue itself, Aphrodite of Knossos. Tell me about that statue and why that was like much more than just, oh, it's a statue of Aphrodite with her tits out. Like the impact that this thing had on the ancient world.
Yes. Okay. So this statue is the first monumental nude female statue. It's the Aphrodite of Cnidos. And what's interesting is in the historical record, we don't have a lot that mentions the statue when it's first sculpted, you know, in probably 350s, 340s. Again, by Praxiteles, who is like the most famous sculptor from ancient Greece. And so the other thing that we find with the hetaira, there's a real push to link them to famous men. And if there's a man who lived kind of around that time, we're going to get them together. But there are several statues that are connected to Phryne and Praxiteles. So I think it's guaranteed that the two of them knew each other, whether they were romantically associated. That's the other question. So we have Praxiteles and Phryne linked somehow. And then we start to see in the Hellenistic period the mentions of the Aphrodite of Cnidos as this statue is becoming famous and copied and sent all around the Greek and then the Roman world. So we have a real push to kind of consume Greek culture, you know, through Phryne, through the statue. So we're going to put these two together. But this statue, in the stories about it, seems to have caused a bit of a splash, at least later on. It became like a tourist attraction. So Cnidos is a city in what's now Turkey on the coast. And it was probably... this nude statue was in a round temple, we think. So you can think about going and you can walk around the statue. And she's posed in a way so that her nudity, she's not, you know, standing with her arms wide open. She's got one hand sort of hiding her vulva. She is sort of leaning. She's got a water jar and a cloth that she's either just removing or putting on. So there's even like a little narrative. Are you catching the nude Aphrodite in the bath? Is she preparing for to meet a lover? And depending on the angle that you look at the statue, you can go around it. You might get a different narrative too, right? So it's this very complicated statue. Now, because it's a nude statue and because it's the first monumental female nude statue, this seems to have really impressed people in ancient Greece. And so we have a lot of stories about people who encounter the statue and they can't control themselves when they see it. They fall in love with it, right? So one of the most famous statues is a young man at Cnidos falls in love with the statue and he contrives to have himself locked into this little round temple with it overnight. And makes love to the statue. And so famously, this statue has a stain on the marble of its buttock that is a semen stain. And to kind of loop back to that letter that is Alciphron's letter that is attributed to Phryne.
And that's why we can't have nice things.
Yeah, because Greek men keep trying to sleep with statues. Ancient Greek men, I should be careful.
God. Sorry. Tell me about the letters.
Oh, yeah. No, in the letter, when she says, we're not going to defile these things, she uses this term in Greek that is the same term that's used in the stories about it's the word for stain, right? So she's also saying, like, we're not going to be like the people who are, you know, having sex with statues, basically.
Just.
Yeah. So this makes a big splash. So you can see why. There's a push to take this woman who is famous and beautiful. And there are a few stories about her being nude in public and to put her together with this famous nude statue. There's already a connection to Praxiteles. So there's a real push to get all of these things together.
Yeah, that makes sense. My other favorite Phryne story is the one where she offered to rebuild the walls of Thebes.
Yeah. So famously, again, and I think this speaks to the fact that she probably was quite wealthy in her own lifetime. But famously, she said, yes, I'll rebuild the walls of Thebes for you. Alexander the Great and his army had raised them. And she said, as long as you put an inscription on them that says Alexander raised these walls, but Phryne put them back up. There's a little bit more to that, too, because, again, she's famously witty. Thespiae had been destroyed and sacked by the Thebans. So that's not a gracious offer. That's an ironic offer on her part.
Oh, she's so smart. I'll be back with Melissa and Phryne after this short break.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Don Wildman, and on American History Hit, my expert guests and I journey across the nation and through the years to uncover the stories that have made the United States. From first flight to first ladies, from stitching the Star-Spangled Banner to striking gold in California, to shooting for the moon with Apollo, we've got you covered. Catch new episodes of American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
The brains and the beauty and the wit, it didn't keep her out of court, which is interesting, as you were saying earlier, is that they're still very vulnerable because all of this power is very dependent on quite a fickle male appreciation, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So tell me, how does our girl end up in court? What happens?
Okay, so we're not sure how she ends up in court. Again, in Alciphron's letters, there are three letters about this court case, but it's a fellow named Euthias who brings her into court. So the suggestion in Alciphron's letters is that Phryne and Euthias had been in a relationship. And when it broke up, basically he took her to court. In the letters, I think it says she asked him for payment and instead he took her to court. Now, whether that's a fictionalization by Alciphron, you know, it's likely. Because the other thing that happens with sex workers that we know of historically is that they get brought into court as a way of getting back at the men that they're affiliated with, too. It's a way for two men to work out a problem using a woman who's the one who's sort of carrying the burden of everything that's at stake. So she gets brought to court. The charge is impiety. And in classical Athens, impiety is a very flexible charge. It's sort of anything that looks like you are acting in a way that's counter to what's sacred. So we are told by a later legal scholar that she has introduced a new god who is called Isodites. And all he says is that this is a foreign god who is worshipped by trifling women, which I think is a shot at Phryne.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Do we know anything about this god?
That's
never
all
heard
we know.
Of him before. That's it.
That's all we know.
Didn't catch on then, did it?
Oh. No, didn't. Probably associated with Dionysus, though, whose worship brings together enslaved and free and men and women and mixes up all the social boundaries. So probably affiliated with Dionysus. She has been acting poorly in the Lyceum, which is a shrine to Apollo. But also this is, of course, where Aristotle's school will be or is. It's where a lot of elite young men who are challenging the status quo hang out too. So what's going on there? And as well, there's a third charge. She's charged with having sort of sacred worship groups with men and women together. So you can see the real concern is that she's mixing up social standing.
She is a busy girl.
Yeah. The other thing to remember with this charge is this is the same charge that Socrates gets brought up on too.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It seems to be if you have someone that you have trouble with.
That's the one.
And you don't like what they're doing. That's the charge, because it's so flexible, but it's also sticky, right? It's the kind of thing that once you've been accused of it, it's very hard to defend oneself against.
That's clever. All right, so she ends up in court, and you might think that this would be an absolute breeze for Phryne, because clearly she has money and she has connections. But I find it very interesting that she's still at the mercy of men and of the patriarchy, and she absolutely, as soon as she's not occupying that space of fascination and awe, she's very easy to like throw away and throw down. And the court case is not easy for Phryne. So can you like what are the sources that we have left to tell us what happened here?
Okay. So a lot of our sources, of course, come from that imperial period. So again, second century CE, we have a fellow named Athenaeus who collects everything he can find about the Hetairai. And in fact, everything he can find about ancient Greek culture. We have Plutarch, who has a biography of the advocate for Phryne. His name is Hyperides. He's a very notable and wealthy man himself. Hyperides, which is very interesting, has multiple Hetaira girlfriends in multiple homes around Attica. We hear he kicks his son out of the house so he can keep one. So he's got three different houses, three different Hetaira.
Oh, dear.
And then it's also suggested that he is in love with Phryne, too. Because, again, I think you can't have a Hetaira and a notable man and not try to get them into bed together somehow. In these stories. Yes. Legal scholars love, though, this speech. They love Hyperides. He's a talented orator. So they're very, very interested in him, too. But basically, you've got two of the kind of the sexiest people in Athens coming together in this big blockbuster trial. So yeah. We have a few fragments of the speech. And we know from a play that was written a few generations later that the trial had become famous by that point. But that play says that Phryne, at the end, when it seemed like she was just about to be convicted, and this is a capital charge, possibly. So she could be even put to death. So she goes to the jury, and we've got 501 Athenian men would be there on the jury.
Wow.
And she goes to them individually and beseeches them. This is what we hear in the play. That seems like an impossibility to me. I don't think you could do that. But the story that starts to get added to this in the Hellenistic period and later is that Hyperides, at this point, when it seems like she's just about to be convicted, he takes her robe, her clothing, and whips it off. And there she is standing nude before, and especially there's an emphasis on her breasts, but she's standing nude before the jury. And that Athenaeus says they all fall into awe because here is the agent of Aphrodite in front of them. They look almost like a religious awe. But I think, you know, she's a sex worker. Of course, she's an agent of Aphrodite in that very literal sense. But they can't help but acquit her because she is so stunning before them. And so that's the story that gets told.
So the defense there was basically, she can't be guilty with tits like these. That was the defense.
Basically. Basically. Or maybe she's guilty, but it doesn't matter because we can't.
Because she's too beautiful.
These beautiful breasts to death. That's right.
I mean, wow, that's a hell of a defense, isn't it? I suppose, if I'm being generous, I suppose that you could kind of look at it as like, if she's on charge for impiety, as in that she's pissed the gods off, is the argument that, well, she can't have pissed them off because they would never have made her this beautiful? Or is it just, but she's got great tits?
I think it's a combo. I think it's a combo. The other thing is that there's a literary tradition of women in times of duress, when they're asking for pity, revealing their breasts. And one of the women who does that.
I've done that myself many times.
Yeah. You know, who hasn't amongst
Who hasn't, right? So want some extra chips from the chippy on a Friday? Get them out.
Exactly. But Helen of Troy is famous for doing this. And there are some scenes when, during the sack of Troy, Menelaus comes back and he's going to kill her because he's so angry about, you know, having had to go to war over her. And he's got a sword out, basically. And she reveals her breasts and he's stunned and can't kill her. There's even a scene in a lost epic by a fellow named Stesichorus where the whole Greek army is facing against Helen, and she does that. She reveals herself and they drop, they're all about to stone her, and they drop their stones. So what I suspect is happening is this literary tradition is making its way into the stories about Phryne. And I often think of Phryne as kind of a human Helen, or a non-mythological Helen, a historical Helen, because she has that same interest in her beauty. She has the same power in her beauty. And she's this controversial woman. She's not doing the right thing, which Helen of Troy certainly doesn't do either.
Do you think there is any chance in hell that this actually happened? Or do you think it's just fun stories?
I think it's just a fun story. I wish, part of me wishes for this, because it's also an expression of that dynamic that you were just talking about, where she's really vulnerable. And there's this obsession with these vulnerable women. And they sort of, so they gather cultural power because of that, right? They're able to be powerful in that way. And there's a lot of discomfort around that. So part of me is like, you're obsessed with me? You want to put me to death because you don't know what to do with me? Well, take a look, right? This is what this is all about. It's sort of the end game of that kind of thought.
Yeah.
So I kind of wish it was true. I mean, there's so much about Phryne that I wish I could know for certain. And I think that's one of those things.
She has this court case, which, whether or not she got her boobs out, we're not sure. But it seems like there was a court case of some description, because there's corroborating evidence of it.
Yeah.
Do we have any sense of what happens to her afterwards? Does she just bounce right back, or has the court case done serious damage to her?
So the challenge is too with these, all of these anecdotes, is any kind of chronological order, right? Is to figure out when this happens. So I definitely think she bounces back in some sense. I think she stays fairly wealthy. One of the plays that is produced during her lifetime puts her on stage as a fury.
Oh.
So furies, right, are these characters, these mythological characters that are spirits of vengeance, and they chase you endlessly. And so it's a play about a fellow who is notoriously a pederast. So he's interested in boys. And the chorus of the play seems to have been elderly sex workers who are clearly chasing him because they want him to be interested in them. You know, he's not patronizing them. They want his money. And so she's one of them, right? And so I think she still stays in the public eye to a certain extent. Mm. And again, she's famous enough that she's like that cultural referent that people can say, oh, Phryne, you know, is this. And it hits, the joke hits, the joke lands. Yeah. So whatever happens, she stays prominent, which is interesting. I've just mentioned Socrates' trial. Of course, Socrates gets put to death.
Yeah, shit tits.
But I think, I'm certain that if she was put to death, we would know. Yeah.
Yes, I think that we would know, wouldn't we? So one of the things I want to ask you about, sex work in ancient Greece in general, because we need to be very careful. It's very easy to look at someone like Phryne and go, oh my God, it was a right laugh. I would have definitely been doing that. But it's for every Phryne, there would have been thousands of people living really difficult, wretched, troubling lives. But what was the status of sex work in ancient Greece? They can't all have been gabillionaires with, you know, a witty repartee for everyone.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is the thing. And we know there was, you know, a fairly thriving sex trade in a place like classical Athens. Corinth seems to be the city that gets associated with the sex trade. It's a port city, right? It's a big, wealthy port city. So you can imagine sex trade flourishes in port cities around the world, right? It sort of always has. Yeah. But in classical Athens, we do hear of there are different terms that we use for sex workers. And so the more generic one is porne. And it's where we get our word pornography from, right? The first person who uses pornography, pornographos in Greek, but pornographer, is a fellow named Athenaeus. And he's talking about a guy who just keeps talking and writing about prostitutes and sex workers. So porne is often thought by a lot of scholars, and there's a lot of debate around these terms, to be kind of that lower class. I think it's just a generic term for sex workers.
Okay.
And the truth is that I suspect a lot of these hetairai who become so legendary, people like Phryne, probably at one point in their careers were probably maybe working in a brothel, right? Not what we would think of as like a courtesan, not glamorous at all. And so we know of brothels. Sometimes the Athenian state will subsidize brothels. There's a recognition that, you know, people need to go patronize sex workers. I suspect most of them are enslaved.
Yeah.
It probably wasn't a very pleasant lifestyle. There's a house, it's called Bauzi. That's the Germans excavated it. So that's what we call it. But that place is also seems to be a bit of a workshop as well. And the term for a brothel is the same as the term for a workshop. So there's this idea that it's the sort of heavy duty physical labor, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lot, a lot of debate about, you know, which women we can confidently say were sex workers.
Yeah.
And I think we still sort of fall into the trap of saying like, oh, this woman's out in public, sex worker, right? Or she's moving between circles. But it's also sexual labor, right? It's a really tricky thing to identify even in 2024. So it's just as challenging to identify in the ancient world. But then you add that layer of concerns over women in public, and that causes us to, you know, sometimes identify women wrongly. But the other thing is, I don't want us to be afraid to, when we do know a woman is a sex worker, that's okay. We don't want to be pornophobic about that either, right? This is
exactly. This
is what these women were doing to make a living. And they had clientele. There was a space for them in society, even if it was a challenging one to negotiate.
We're all selling something.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that when you're researching, especially the history of sex work, is that you're constantly unpicking modern preconceptions or modern assumptions. Because one of the things that I found very difficult to square was this idea that in the ancient world that you are enslaved, but they can also be celebrities. And you see that as well with geisha and with lots of different customs. I can never remember what her name is. The one that you mentioned earlier, Manera, who was, she was also ended up in a trial with two men being really shitty about her. And that there are stories about when she was enslaved as a child. But she was hugely famous and also still enslaved to a brothel.
Yeah. So she seems to have acquired, at least according to this legal speech, and we want to remember the legal speech about her is the speech against her. So I'd love to have the defense speech. I would love it.
God, wouldn't you?
But this is the story of how we tell the story of women in the ancient world. Our sources are always shaped by these dynamics, and we have to unpick that as much as we can. But yeah, so Neaira, yeah, we know that she was in a brothel at a very young age. She was picked because she was beautiful. The woman who ran the brothel herself had been enslaved. So I suspect it's not an uncommon trajectory for women who survive, because you can imagine in the sex trade in the ancient world, there's going to be a lot of unplanned pregnancies. There's going to be probably some STIs. So a lot of risk involved, I would imagine. So the woman who chose her because she was so beautiful. She herself had been enslaved, had become free. And then Neaira follows that same pattern. But then we still hear, even once she's free, she's with a partner. And this is supposed to slander her. But when we read it more generously and more from Neaira's perspective, he's taking her to parties. And at parties, she's getting drunk. And then at the end of the night, she's even sleeping with the other enslaved people in the household. And to me, you know, is this consenting sex? It's hard to tell because of the way it's being shaped by the prosecutor. But you can really see the challenges for the people who are involved in the sex trade.
Yeah.
You can see even, you know, maybe once you have become free, it's not just that you become this glamorous hetaira, right, who can say yes and no to anyone.
No.
The getting free, the getting the finances, and perhaps getting to a point where you can set up your own household is one heck of a challenge. And then again, there's Athenian men. If they're unhappy with you, they're going to take you to court. Mm. So navigating all of that requires, I think, a real set of skills that we have to acknowledge in these women.
Right.
But also the vulnerabilities are just constantly present for them.
Yeah. What do you think Freeney's legacy is? I mean, she's this kind of tour de force of the ancient world. She's a woman who very much set herself up and played a blinder of a hand, but she still has ongoing influences. I mean, you said earlier that there were links between her and Paris and sex work. What was that? Yeah.
So in the 19th century, there are, of course, painters who are obsessed with the ancient world. So there's always this sort of compulsion. And in 1861, there's a fellow named Jean-Léon Gérôme, and he's part of a movement called the Neo-Grec movement. So all of his paintings are very detailed paintings of antiquity. And in the 1861 Salon de Paris, he has a painting, and it's Phryne before the judges. And in it, you see Phryne, and she is standing in the middle, and she's in a pose that mimics a famous painting from the ancient world of Aphrodite coming out of the sea. And she's sort of wringing out her hair. She's got her hands up to her side. Mm. It's a pose that we see in modern artwork all the time. Phryne, by the way, is also credited with inspiring that painting because, of course, she had come out of the sea nude at a festival one day. And everyone was so, you know, stunned at the sight of her beautiful nude body in public. So he has painted and he's got all the judges around her and they all have these different facial expressions of shock and awe and all the emotions that we were just talking about. And she's standing there nude. And the way that this woman is painted, she's so pale and white. She really does look like a marble statue. And she's clearly meant to, in a sense. And that's also supposed to invoke, again, like the Aphrodite of Cnidos that we talked about and the tradition of nude Aphrodites that come from that. So this caused kind of a mild scandal in 1861. But it also caused a big splash, a broad splash in French society. So people, for example, bought little statues of the Phryne from that painting. And so, you know, your bourgeois household would have a little Phryne in it, right? And then people started doing, you know, political cartoons. But the other thing that's going on in Paris at that time, as we're starting to see more of these nude paintings, and these are the nude paintings that lead into like Manet's Olympia, really famous nudes that challenge the idea of what nudity and nakedness is in art, and especially for a woman, and they're affiliated, the assumption is the models for all these paintings are sex workers. The other thing that's happening is on stage in Paris, in sort of the last couple of decades of the 19th century, is they're starting to push the limits with nude spectacle at places like the Folies Bergères. They're putting nude women on stage or nearly nude women on stage. And so there's this combination of, we have the artists' models who are also sometimes the same women performing. They're having photographs taken of them nude and circulated. And then there are stories being told about these women. The assumption is that they are involved in the sex trade somehow. So Phryne, this painting of Phryne comes along, and it sort of starts the trend, but it also feeds into these other trends. And so people start putting on the story of Phryne on stage because it's a great way to get a naked lady or a nearly naked lady on stage. But then you can also say, oh, well, it's about antiquity, right? We're doing a cultural event here.
Yes, you have cultural, the imprimatur. Yeah. It's all very highbrow.
Exactly. Yeah. Every time they do this, every time we have a painting of Phryne or we have a Phryne on stage, you also have a woman whose stories and the anecdotes about her are kind of used to publicize it. So, for example, the woman who poses for the photos that Jérôme uses for his original painting is a woman named Marie-Christine Leroux. And she's a model, right? And she's assumed to be a sex worker. She becomes the inspiration for Musetta in La Bohème. So you can see the stories of these women being shaped as well. One of the women who plays Phryne in a comic opera is Cléo de Merode, who's a famous dancer. She has a famous nude statue of herself that gets made too by the same sculptor who sculpted the little tiny Phrynes that everyone is buying in the 1860s.
Wow.
Everyone knows each other in these circles. But she is said to be the lover of King Leopold of Belgium. And this is so infamous, they actually have their own couple name. So before Brangelina, we had Cléopold. So all of these feed into the story of Phryne. And so you always have these women whose own stories are building up in the way that Phryne's stories built up in her lifetime. So where you see the movement from the real woman to like the legend, right? And that feeds into the publicity of Phryne. So Cléo de Merode, when she's performing as Phryne, one of the plays or one of the performances is at a seaside town. She makes a point of going down to the sea like Phryne to be seen, right? In the same way, of course, she's wearing a bathing costume. She's not nude, but she is tying into all of the stories of Phryne And then she's performing her on stage. And then there's a new set of stories about her. And so we see this real obsession with sort of consuming women, right? Mm. Consuming the stories of women, being titillated by them. But again, they're still in these vulnerable positions. They can be kind of disposed of when they become inconvenient. But again, we see that interest, the same kind of interest from the ancient world replaying again.
Oh, Melissa, you have been utterly fascinating to talk to today. Thank you so much for talking to me. And if people want to know more about you and your work, where can they find you?
Well, they can find my book, Phrynia Life in Fragments, from Bloomsbury Academic.
Find the book.
Absolutely. You can also find me on Twitter, where I talk a lot about people like Phrynia and the various Hetairai. I think I'm not done with talking about them. There's other ones that I want to look into, and I think their stories deserve the same kind of examination.
And we will absolutely have you back to talk about them when you do. Thank you so much. You have been wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and thank you so much to Melissa for joining me. And if you like what you heard, you know the drill. Don't forget to like, review, and follow along wherever it is that you get your podcasts. You can consider it a 200th birthday present. But if you want us to explore a subject, or maybe you just wanted to say hello, then you can now email us at betwixt@historyhit.com. We've got episodes on everything from queer sex in Jacobean Britain to Abraham Lincoln's sex life all coming your way. This podcast was edited and produced by Stuart Beckwith. The senior producer was Charlotte Long. Join me again Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, a podcast by History Hit. This podcast contains music from Epidemic Sound. Thank you for listening to this episode of Betwixt the Sheets. Please follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use the code BETWIXT at checkout.